Okay, if we can find our seats, we'll take out our little camp hymnal, and number 21. Let's all stand together, and we'll sing. Potter to come. He'll be speaking to us later on tonight and a couple more times throughout the week. I'm going to have him to come and introduce our speaker. He probably knows Doug better than anybody here, and I want him to have that honor. Thank you.
I've known Douglas Phillips when he was a student at William & Mary, back before Belle Dewey, his current wife, was only a gleam in his eye. And he did finally graduate from William & Mary and went on to greater glory at George Mason School of Law. He is currently an attorney for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, the HSLDA. Doug is a nationally known speaker. He speaks in conferences all over the country, conferences of different types. He even sponsors some from time to time. The whole of Douglas Phillips is greater than the sum of the parts. He is a very keen student of the scriptures and also of history. He's an avid reader. He has probably the most inquiring and one of the most brilliant minds that I have ever met in my life. And I'll tell you, if Doug had been there on that third day at Gettysburg as Pickett's division was beginning to step off, it would not have been a safe place to be near him, because he would have been in the front rank and he would have been running toward the Union lines in order to be the first to get at the Yankees. So he would not be safe to be next to in a charge. All accolades aside, though, I think that the best thing that can be said for Doug is his epitaph should be very simple. Here lies a man who feared God. And when Doug speaks, he has definitely has something to say. So let us give our attention to Doug Phillips as he addresses us at this time.
I am a follower of the Lord Jesus Christ, and as such, in this instance, this is a conference on revival during the war. It's important that I tell you the truth, and I make a public confession before each and every one of you. I have been a resident of the state of Virginia for 25 years, 25 glorious, proud years. But prior to that time, yes, it's true, I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. Not only was I born in Boston, Massachusetts, but my mother was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and my father was born in Boston, Massachusetts. And despite that ignominious heritage, I'm here to tell you today that revival can even come to a Yankee. And we have all been repatriated, at least most of us have, I certainly have, and we thank the Lord for living down here. But we're one of many people who are making not only an exodus out of the government school systems with their revisionist history about the war between the states, but who are coming to embrace the wonderful heritage that we have as Southerners, which just goes to show you, in the case of Boston, that even a broken clock is right twice a week or twice a day. So even a broken clock can be right. But we're here today to talk about one of the men I consider to be formulative in my own thinking, one of the great men of the South, a friend of the great General Jackson, and perhaps the greatest apologist. And by apologist, we don't mean apologies, but defender of not only the Southern heritage, but of the Reformed faith, of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and of just plain sound thinking and common sense, Mr. Robert Louis Dabney. Mr. Dabney said, more than 100 years ago now, he said this: truth is never out of date. It has sometimes happened that a tentative experience has thrown so much light upon a bad system as to reopen the discussion with better guidance than the previous. The headline or the topic for our talk is Robert Louis Dabney's Vision of Education, or Robert Louis Dabney versus Goals 2000. As somebody who works in the home education community and very grateful for that opportunity to see what God is doing in the hearts of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of families where their hearts are turning to home, they're desiring to train up their children in the fear of the Lord, I will tell you that many people are entering home education, leaving the government school systems for different reasons. But one reason is that things have gotten so bad that, in the words of Mr. Dabney, the tentative experience has thrown so much light upon a bad system as to reopen the discussion with better guidance than the previous. To show you the folly of our current thinking, I'd like to share with you a comment that was given to me, not too long ago by one of my Yankee friends. This gentleman pulled me aside and said, "Philip, what in the world are you doing helping all these homeschoolers? These kids are going to be in a lot of trouble. They're not going to be socialized. They're not going to look like the public school kids. They're not going to be able to relate and use the language of the public school children. They're not going to be able to act that way. What are you doing? You live in a fantasy world, Philip. You're not going to ever see these people grow up to be the sort of people you want to see." And I said to him, "Well, friend, tell me, pray, what do you think is such a positive experience that you had in going to the government school system?" And what he said to me was, he said, "The best thing that ever happened to me was when somebody pulled a gun on me in class. It taught me to be a man." Now, if you will agree with me that that sort of thinking is a little bit backwards, a little bit wrong, then we're on good ground to examine some of the thoughts of Mr. Robert Louis Dabney. I'd like to share with you another comment that Dabney said, just about home education, since we're talking about it. He said this: "Home education is so much potential, so much more potential than that of the school, that the little modicum of training which a common school system can give to the average masses is utterly trivial and impotent as a means of reversing the child's tendency." Mr. Dabney was, from beginning to end, a believer in parental responsibility. He was a believer in parental rights. He was a believer in authority and jurisdiction. He was a believer in God's sovereignty. He was a believer that God has ordained institutions in order to train up those people who need help, like children. Those of you who are with us on Sunday, we had an opportunity to talk about the Southern perspective on patriarchy, and we saw that over a 100-year period in the 19th century, the vision for the family, the model which existed all the way up to the time of the war in the South and had previously been true even in the northern states, reflected a lifestyle wherein young people were involved in the lives of their parents, parents were involved in the lives of their young people, there was a legacy, a tradition that was passed on, the home was a center of economic vitality, fathers brought America the record of having the greatest literacy rate in the entire world, according to a study by Thomas Jefferson done in 1800, because fathers were waking up every morning and teaching their children how to read the Bible at the breakfast table. The sense of personal responsibility on the parts of the parents for training up a righteous generation was profound, it was sincere, it was deep, and the fury that came from New England progressivism, from radicalism, from the universities, from the German higher criticism, which gave the students who attended the universities of the North a hatred for the Word of God, the suffragette spirit, the spirit of the abolitionist, all of these were inimically opposed to the family model. All of these represented the new belief in a radical democratization of theology, a belief that that old idea of a sovereign God that elects his people, that's out of date. That old idea that all men are inherently sinners in need of salvation, that's out of date. In our new paradigm of perfectibility, we can create a utopia on earth. Man is basically good. All men are not only equal in a moral sense, but all men should have perfect equality of circumstances. Thus, the wealthy man must be leveled, and hence we get the word the levelers, so that he is on an equal plane, and the poor man must be brought up, and it's the role of the government to do this. And the number one vehicle for achieving this utopic, transcendental, radical Jacobin philosophy, the number one vehicle was the common school system, the government schools. And the government schools were created for the sole purpose of raising up this new generation. And this is the world that Dabney spoke to. This is the world that Dabney prophesied about. And as we shall see, without exception, each of the 10 to 20 prophecies that Dabney made about what would happen to our country if we embraced this satanically inspired system of common school education, each of these prophecies came true to the letter more than we could have ever even imagined had we lived in the 1880s and 90s and 70s when Dabney was putting pen to paper. Well, you've heard speeches before, and you've heard probably numerous talks about the status of today's government school system. I don't want to bore you with all the details. You've heard it so many times. You know that we have a literacy rate which is shameful. More than 60 million Americans, the United States government survey says, are basically illiterate in the sense that they cannot read in order to help themselves. And almost in direct proportion to the amount of money we pour into statist government education, the crime rate goes up, illiteracy goes up, education standards go down. Almost in direct proportion to every new reform mechanism that's advocated, government education sinks to a lower and lower depth of depravity. The vision of the utopian dreamers of the 19th century has fallen flat. And yet, despite the fact, there are still people who believe it's a good thing for 12-year-olds to have guns put to their head in schools. Incredible as it is, the vast majority of Americans operate on the premise that the very same state system, which has vowed not to allow Jesus Christ into the classroom, is the system that should raise and train and care for their children 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And do we wonder why we have the problems that we have in America today? The moral crisis in the government schools is profound. We know that the drug rates are at all-time highs. You've no doubt heard the quotes before of the surveys that were done in the 1960s about what teachers feared the most, and it was chewing gum and raising hands out of turn, and today it's rape and swearing and murder in the classroom. We've come a very, very long way. But each of these phenomena, each one to a letter, were predicted by Robert Louis Dabney 100 years ago. Every single one of them, the great prophet of the South. I was sharing with those of us who were with us on Sunday that Dabney, one of his strengths lies in the fact that he has a tremendous ability to go to the heart of a matter. He has the precision of a master surgeon who takes his intellectual scalpel on the malignant thinking of his opponents, and then he proceeds to systematically root out each and every one of their cancerous reasonings. And yet, Dabney is never content just to deal with the surface tumor as we look at his writings. His pen will not rest until he's sought out and destroyed every cancerous cell of specious, hypocritical, self-serving, or inconsistent reasoning. Dabney is eminently logical, and long before the great Dr. Cornelius Van Til went to Westminster Seminary and did so much in the area of presuppositional apologetics, long before Francis Schaeffer came out and popularized the concept that there is no neutrality, long before that, Robert Louis Dabney was using these very terms and articulating these very concepts in his writings, discussing the importance of thinking presuppositionally and understanding the eras of the Yankee radical opponents from a presuppositionally biblical perspective of realizing that there is no neutrality in education, in life, in any area of thought, that the Word of God must be made clear and every thought must be taken captive to the obedience of Jesus Christ. Robert Louis Dabney was saying all of these things. 100 years ago, he was saying all of these things. His logic is always brutally sound and his conclusions are painfully accurate. Dabney says things that you and I think, but many of us are afraid to say. He says it. He's not afraid to say it. He's bold. He lived in a day when men weren't afraid to discuss things. Today, we have to place so many caveats before every single sentence we say, we can't even get anything out. Well, I'm for the South, but I really don't mean I'm for this, but I'm kind of for that, but I'm not. Oh, but you understand I'm balanced, don't you? Because I'm really not one of these kooky people. Robert Louis Dabney wasn't a man like that. Robert Louis Dabney, the great defender of the South, the great apologist of the South, the man who stood by Stonewall Jackson's side, said what he believed. He said it fairly. He said it persuasively. But he said it boldly and uncompromisingly, and for that, many didn't like it. He was a prophet in the fullest sense. He was a quintessential prophet, bold, full of truth, and resented by those who don't want to hear the prophecy. And to this day, there are many evangelicals and Christians who should know better, who when confronted with the reasoning and logic and the very words of Robert Louis Dabney, are too afraid of associating with him to acknowledge the merit of his prophecies. We may be uncomfortable with his conclusions sometimes. We may feel condemned by the weightiness of the judgment he pronounces, and we may even feel overwhelmed by the responsibility which we incur upon learning of our great abdication from leadership, which Dabney exposes before our very eyes. But we're left with no other options but to run and hide. We can't deny it, or simply to embrace the truth and realize that we need to flee to Christ and do what the Lord has told us to do, to reclaim our parental responsibilities in the area of education. I'd like to talk to you about Dabney's basic thesis of education. Dabney wrote a number of articles, which Brother Sprinkle has collected and has republished in this excellent volume that I want to bring to your attention. For those of you who haven't read it, it's just superb, Discussions by Robert Louis Dabney, Volume 4, Secular. In this particular volume, there are approximately 7 articles and letters which Robert Louis Dabney wrote on the issue of education. He tackles the issue from several different angles. But his main points include some of the following. Number one, Dabney believed emphatically that education could not be neutral. And for this reason, the whole idea of secular education, he said, was a logical impossibility. Dabney understood very clearly, even as others, Dr. Rushdoony and others, have tried to articulate in recent years, that education is inescapably a religious discipline. It's impossible to make education void of religious content, because all education presupposes a worldview. It presupposes a basic paradigm, a construct, a way for evaluating facts, a way for interpreting things. The questions you ask versus the questions you don't even ask, the issues you discuss versus the issues you don't discuss, reflect your basic worldview, what you think is important and what you don't think is important. And that's why it should come as no surprise that in our atheistic system of government schools, the vast majority of students who were polled and asked when Columbus came to the United States thought that it was after the year 1500. The vast majority of them confused portions of the Communist Manifesto with the United States Constitution, and 40% could not determine when the Civil War occurred. That's the status, because there are certain facts we choose to ignore. There are certain facts we keep out. Robert Louis Dabney, when addressing the problem of the government school system, pointed out that from its inception, it was created as part of this transcendentalist philosophy for remaking America. The transcendentalists never got as many people to embrace their faith as they were effective in terms of generally changing the framework of debate. In other words, not everyone listened to Emerson, Thoreau, and other transcendentalists and said, I'm going to become a transcendentalist. But what they did was they shifted the terms of debate. And by getting in control of the government school system, They prepared the North for war against the South by fueling the students who were going through the common schools at that time with an anti-Southern fervor, an anti-Southern attitude, and a perspective with respect to rights, children's rights, women's rights, a whole bunch of things which said, the South is undemocratic, we must put it down. Dabney saw this. He understood it before the war happened. It sowed the seeds for hatred and anger, which ultimately fueled the terrorism, the first officially organized government terrorism in the United States, as John Brown and others went out and executed innocent children in Kansas and other places around the country. All in the name of rights, all in the name of equality, all in the name of democratization, the government schools became an instrument for terror. And Dabney saw that. As I think you'll see, and I hope you'll agree with me by the time we're done, that if we are to accept Mr. Dabney's conclusions as valid, then we're left with the inescapable conclusion, and this is painful, this hurts, that 95% of the political efforts advanced by the evangelical community in America are ill-conceived, misguided, and doomed to failure. Because all of them operate on the paradigm of the radical transcendentalist movement 100 years later. To the degree that we seek, and we'll talk about this, to get the government to pass around the funds a little bit more through the form of vouchers, it's a redistribution of the wealth program, it's socialistic, and it's attempt. Dabney would say, he addressed it back in the 19th century, it's a means whereby false religions would be propagated and established. To the degree that we seek to make the government schools a little bit better, we expend our funds, our resources, and our times in a system Dabney believed was utterly failed to doom, when we could better use those resources to build Christian education, to help people who truly needed education and who wanted that education. If Dabney and others like him, Hodge and Machen and others who followed, are correct, then even our efforts, as well-intentioned as they may seem, to put prayer back in the government schools are exercises in futility. What will the prayers be? Who will say the prayers? And what difference does it make? That was Dabney's response. These are hard words. This is a tough thing to say. I would be stoned in most audiences for even suggesting these things. This is not a politically correct talk, but this is a historically accurate representation of not only the view of Robert Louis Dabney, but a view of many who just didn't have a voice at the time that this was happening, who didn't get to write the history books because they lost the war, who didn't get to take control because others came down and usurped it from them. Dabney stood out. Dabney was alone in many respects in much of the bold, articulate, well-conceived notions he put forward in opposition to the spread of radicalism, hatred of the family, radical democracy. You talk to your average student today and you ask them, what does he think of democracy? And it's almost an idol. Yeah. Democracy is a wonderful thing. Not so for Robert Louis Dabney. Democracy was a means of mobocracy. Democracy was a means whereby a majority of people would impose their will on the few. And this brings me to the second point of what Dabney said. Dabney confounds the liberals. Because Dabney says we should do unto others as we have them do unto us. And Dabney rebuked the Protestants of his day who, in an effort to squelch the papacy and Roman Catholicism, said we need to establish government schools and put Protestantism in it, and we need to subsidize it. Dabney says, hold on a second, folks. What if the tables are turned? Are you telling me, my Protestant friends, that might makes right? That's what you seem to be saying here. What if the tables are turned? What if someday it's not Protestantism, it's something else? Will you agree then to allow the government schools to be in control? Dabney understood that some religion would dominate. Either man will worship and serve the Creator, or they will worship and serve the creature. And since Dabney concluded that we lived in a country of diversity, of multiple religions, Dabney said very, very clearly that it wasn't right for the state to establish education. And along with Dabney, I agree with his conclusion that any attempt to establish a government school would be one of the primary means of having a state-established church. Dabney said the school systems would be the state churches of America. And Dabney advocated the separation of school and state, even as many conservatives are attempting to do today. You know, I was in a meeting a year and a half ago, maybe it was 2 years ago now, with my employer, Michael Ferris, who many of you know, the head of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, a great man of God and a wonderful father, and in many respects a visionary. And we sat in a room with the leaders of Christian conservative groups, great big room. And the purpose of the day was to discuss the education agenda. And every person, almost to a man, minus us, was there to talk about the needs. We need to get more government money through vouchers. That's what we have to do. Michael Ferris said, I summarize, that we should take the same position that Abraham took. When the king of Sodom went before Abraham and said, take of my dainties. Michael Ferris said, I will not take so much as one shoe latchet from you, lest you say you made me wealthy. And the same principle applies in the area of vouchers. We start taking money, the government will get control. Dabney prophesied this 100 years ago. Ferris went on to say at that time, what we really need to do is to reestablish the 10th Amendment and systematically oppose every attempt not only to advance government education, but our goal should be to completely abolish the federal role in education. To that, almost to a person, each of the Christian conservative leaders in that room openly mocked and ridiculed that position. How could you even say such a thing in public? We won't be acceptable. We won't be liked. We will be outside the paradigm of legitimacy in Washington, D.C. if we say this sort of thing. How can we advocate it? It's too radical. It's too extreme. We need to focus our effort on putting our finger in the dike of doom. To this, Dabney would have been repulsed. Dabney would have looked and said, thou effeminate man, hast thou not a backbone? Stand up and speak the truth. And that's what Dabney did. Well, we feel uncomfortable with that. Dabney said that a couple things when he was assailing his Protestant hypocritical friends. He said, number one, America is a society made up of diverse religions, that our form of government will not tolerate the establishment of one sect over another, that violent riots, protests, and hand-to-hand combat had already broken out during Dabney's day because certain non-Protestants had objected at that point in time to using the King James Bible in the common schools. You know, it's interesting. Today, we're arguing over whether or not, and I want to say this discreetly and carefully, matters of intimacy are discussed in great detail with our young ones. Back then, they were arguing whether it was the Douay version or the King James version. People were literally breaking out in hand-to-hand combat over whether or not they'd have King James or Douay in school, and yet parents today sit at home while their children are being defiled and sacrificed on the satanic altars of Baal in the government school classroom. Strong words, no doubt. Strong circumstances, strong times that call for strong words. Dabney would have been shocked, and yet he predicted each and every one of these things. He said that the same principle which leads Protestants to objecting to having their tax money go to subsidize Roman Catholic education should lead Protestants to respect the rights of Catholics. Not the words of an intolerant bigot, but the words of a wise, balanced, intelligent, consistent, systematic, presuppositional Christian thinker. He said it was wrong, even as Thomas Jefferson had said 100 years earlier, to compel a man to subsidize things which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. When I was a student at the College of William and Mary, we decided to start a Christian newspaper, of which I was the publisher for some years. And one of the things that we felt very strongly about was that it was wrong to receive one dime of government aid. We wouldn't do it. We wouldn't touch a penny of that. And you know, the school kept coming back to us and wanted us to take that money. They knew if we took that money, they'd be able to have some sort of editorial control. We wouldn't do it. We thought it was wrong. Just as wrong as the fact that we had to subsidize the leftist groups, they shouldn't have to subsidize us. And isn't that fair? What's the truly consistent position? I guess it was two years ago now, I was sent as a sort of an insurgent to a People for the American Way National Conference to observe. And talk about the skunk at the garden party. After about 4 hours of this, and I was really going there just to observe, my flesh just couldn't stand it any longer, and I went to the front of the aisle where people were asking questions, and I waited to go up to the front, and I said, they were characterizing the position that many Christians had, and they said, these crazy lunatic Christians, they're so unfair, they want to establish their religion in the government school, we're the neutral people, we don't want any religion, we want neutrality. And I went up and I said, you know, there are Christians who hold that position, but the biblical position is that education is the realm of the parent and not of the state, because God hasn't given jurisdiction to the state. Oh, in areas of defending, in areas of punishing evildoers, oh, Scripture is clear. Bearing the sword, that's the domain of the state. But in the area of educating children, that's only the domain of the family. Interestingly, as we'll see in a moment, Dabney made it clear it wasn't even the domain of the church in his view. Now, some might disagree with that, but that was Dabney's position. He said it was the family. If the church wants to help train parents to train their kids, praise God, Dabney said, but don't let the church think that they have jurisdiction as the Catholics had in other countries. But standing up before these people at the People for the American Way rally and saying, I agree with you. We don't want Christianity in the government schools because we don't want government schools. They were astonished. You're being consistent. We don't know how to deal with that. That's too confusing for us. We prefer to ridicule you. And unfortunately, I hate to say it, but as Christians, because we are inconsistent, because we like the dainties of the King, and we don't put that knife to our throat that Scripture tells us we should before dining with Him, because of all these things, we've fallen into each and every one of the traps that Dabney prophesied would happen, and the result, look around you. The result is a culture which is total disarray, chaos, and abandonment. Dabney said that there were only three alternatives for status education. And the first one is this, and these are inevitable. He said, we either force the religion of the majority of the children, of the majority of the people on the minority of the people. And he said that was wrong. That's majoritarianism. We can't do that. The second thing he said is we could adopt what the British call the plan of concurrent endowment. This is something that's taking place in Canada today and other countries, and that some Christians are advocating, and this really is the voucher system. And what the concurrent endowment system is this. It says basically that because government's going to be involved in education, we want to make sure that everybody has equal access to the money. So what we'll do is we'll allow the establishment of Buddhist schools, Hindu schools, Christian schools, secular humanist schools, Taoist schools, and anybody who happens to want to advance a particular philosophy will end up subsidizing them as well. Dabney says this is very, very problematic. And he listed a whole number of reasons. In fact, he listed six reasons why that was a problem. The first one, he said, was this is no solution unless the various denominations are religiously populous. And what he meant by that was if you happen to be a small sect, then you're no good because you're not even enough to qualify to get that money. So the bigger the sect happens to be, once again, we have a might equals right sort of situation, and those will be the people who get most of the money. The second thing he said was this. It's not right from either a Christian perspective or from a philosophy of jurisdiction from the Bible for the state to be coordinating the propagation of creeds which are diametrically opposed. In other words, what you'd have is a situation where the state would literally be part and parcel of helping to establish Hinduism and Buddhism. And this isn't right, on the one hand to advocate Christianity, on the other hand to advocate anti-Christianity. You know, there are many, and even within the homeschool movement, I see this a lot, and we just need to encourage our brethren in this particular area. Good men, wonderful men, speakers, popular speakers, Peter Marshall and David Barton and others out there who have, I think, a different view on the South than we would have, and a different view on history in some of these respects, but many who believe that the real issue is simply cleaning up the government schools. That if we just put the prayer back in, if we do these things, and Dabney said, this will not work. This will be an absolute failure. And in terms of the question of concurrent endowment, he said that it just isn't going to work because even if we try to set up godly Christian schools, we still have the problem that we're going to be subsidizing all these wrong beliefs as well. And he said the state has no right to indicate whether any particular creed is true or not. He also said this, that Protestantism, biblical Christianity, tends to promote thrift and wealth. And therefore, the Christians who are most thrifty and most wealthy will end up footing the bill for all the slothful people who could not make it in the marketplace of ideas. And in fact, this is exactly what we see happening today. You know, for homeschoolers who won't take vouchers, for example, and this isn't a speech on vouchers, but it's a perfect example of what Dabney predicted. For home educators who won't take vouchers, if vouchers are enacted, they're going to have to pay not just a double tax, but a triple tax, because they pay not only for the government schools, but they pay for the private Christian schools, and then they pay for the homeschoolers who take the funds. And so everyone else. And then they have to pay for themselves, of course, too. Dabney said this is a very bad idea. It gives error a pecuniary and moral support, Dabney said, which it would receive, it would not receive from the spontaneous zeal of its votaries. And finally, he said, it puts the government in the position of disuniting the population by training them in hostile religious camps, which is precisely the circumstance in the government schools leading up to the war. So Dabney saw all of these things as a very significant problem. But Dabney also wanted to answer objections that people had. And one of the objections that they had was this. Well, what will happen, and tell me if you've ever heard this before, what will happen, pray tell, if we take our children out of these government schools? What is going to happen to all the people who are in the government schools who won't have the benefit of being around all the good children? I mean, after all, don't we want our children, question is, and you've no doubt heard before, to be missionaries in the public school system? Isn't that what children should be? And Dabney, long before the rise of the modern Christian school movement, long before government education, Dabney said this, sometimes it is asked, how are the degraded classes to be elevated if they are thus to be denied all associations with those better than themselves? We reply that while we fully recognize the Christian duty of seeking the degraded and of drawing them up to purer associations, we beg leave to demur against employing our innocent and inexperienced children as the missionaries. The braving of this moral contagion is the proper work of mature men and women of virtue, and these are to elevate their beneficiaries by holding to them the relationship of benevolent teachers, not of comrades in their iniquity. Again, strong words, but isn't this the same sort of discussion you've had in your family at some point in time? I mean, haven't we all had this discussion either with ourselves or with someone else? But what about the people in the government school? I mean, Phillips, Dabney, all you, Hodge, Machen, all you people, you're standing up there saying we need to pull out. What's going to happen to these people? Dabney said, well, let's understand one thing, just for starters. Our kids are not to be sacrificed as the missionaries. They're not equipped. They're not ordained of God to do this, and the result will be total disaster. Dabney went on. He pointed out a series of other problems. Dabney said this, long before homeschoolers ever came out and said we need to worry about the concerns caused by peer grouping and by pressures from social groups that are artificially created, Dabney made the comment that if you put obedient children who have been trained in righteousness, who have been properly catechized and taught and discipled, and you put them next to people who are essentially heathen, the result will not be the conversion of the heathen, but the degradation of the godly children. And he said, when the state demands through compulsion, through compulsory school attendance, that we put our children in this, it usurps the right of the parent to make these decisions. It ultimately undermines his ability to choose what form of associations a parent can have. For the last 4 years, I've been involved in researching and writing and fighting a document called the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. No doubt you've heard of this document at this point. It's a concern because our Supreme Court, if this were ratified and if it were taken seriously, might consider this to be the supreme law of the land under Article 6, Section 2 of the Constitution. And if they did that, and if they took it seriously, they would also have to take seriously, something, by the way, we would argue against if this ever came up, but if they did take it seriously, the belief that a child has a fundamental right to freedom of association, which is a guaranteed right in the convention. In other words, the very reason why you choose a Christian school or a home school or whatever you happen to do where you are deciding what sort of peer group and influences go into your children, that very right and that very sort of thinking would be systematically undermined, and your child would have a legally enforceable right against his parents in the court of law of America. Dabney saw this over 100 years ago, and he predicted that if the common schools are established, what we would see would be a nation of degenerate children, because the parents would be robbed of the right to oversee the destinies and the education of their children. common schools, he said, will be used to promote moral degradation. But you know, that's not all Dabney saw. Dabney also saw the fact that if you establish a government school system, or if you have people take state money, not even in the form of vouchers, but simply in the form of so-called free education, and he made fun of that. He said, it's free only in name. It's free after you have compelled me to pay for it. It's free. It's free to somebody else, but it costs somebody money, and that somebody is me. But the person who gets it for free, Dabney said, will be destroyed. Because when you take government funds, whatever it happens to be, you become a dependent as opposed to an independent. Dabney saw this. He said, what we need more than anything else is not the money, but is liberty. We need to be free men. And as free men, we can't simply go and look for government handouts and things like that. You know, I'll tell you a little story. Back in 1973, my father was sort of in the Nixon sub-cabinet. He was named as acting director of the Office of Economic Opportunity, which was really one of the greatest welfare spending agencies in America. My dad went there for one reason, and one reason only, and that was to abolish the entire multi-billion dollar agency, which he essentially did, although some of the programs were taken from him and placed in other government agencies. That was his goal, was to completely and totally abolish it. But during the initial stages of his tenure there, he was faced with some very difficult decisions. And one was, he had a responsibility, supposedly under law, to allocate the funds that Congress had appropriated for this agency and to give it out to different groups. Now, previously, before he came to the government agency, he said to himself, we need to get this money to conservatives. Take it away from the liberals, take it away from Planned Parenthood, and let's give it to the conservatives. When he got there, and when he saw what was happening when conservative and Christian groups were receiving the funds, he became convinced forever that one of the worst things you can do to anyone is to make them a dependent. One of the worst things you want to guarantee to destroy the soul of an individual? Make them a welfare recipient. Make them a dependent. And it was actually worse because it destroyed the psyche, the conscience, and the morals of the Christian groups to reallocate the funds in their direction because of the way they changed their attitudes in order to keep getting that money from the government. And I've seen over the years, whether it's universities which are being established or whatever, that Christians, whenever they see the glint of money and they want money more than they want to do it God's way, they'll inevitably move in that direction. Dabney predicted that. Dabney said this, imperial donatives to the Roman populace became very popular. True. But they poisoned the last good element of Roman character and helped to complete the putrescence of the empire. I fear it is only too true that this cunning cheat of a Yankee statecraft is alluring the poor, harassed Southern parent, and he is yielding to the bait which promises deceitfully to relieve him of his parental responsibility. A bribe, alas, may easily become popular in decadent times. But a man, this is a great quote, a man must be just before he is generous. Robert Louis Dabney. He said this, the Yankees have had this nostrum of free school education in full force for two generations. Has it reared up among them, out of the white people, a popular mass fit to enjoy universal suffrage? Did not this very system rear us that very generation, which in its blind ignorance and brutal passion has recently wrecked the institutions of America, has filled our country with destitution, woe, and murder, with a stupid blindness only equaled by its wickedness, has stripped its own commonwealth in order to wreak its mad spite and ours of the whole safeguards for their own freedom and peace? These are the true fruits of this Yankee system of state primary education. Young people think old people fools, Dabney said, but old people know that the young ones are. And the spirit, the innovative spirit of the radical suffragette, of the transcendentalist, of Horace Mann and John Dewey, and the architects of this new world order 19th century school system, all of these people, to a man, they believed that anything that was old was dangerous. Wipe it out. Get rid of it. You know, nothing's changed. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. This is what happened under Hitler. This is what happened under Stalin. You remember when Pol Pot came to power in the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, the very first thing they wanted to do was to wipe out anybody who wore glasses or who were intelligent or who represented the other generation so that they could have a pure, new, young generation. And thus they committed one of the largest mass murders in the history of the world. 1 million people, a third of the people in their country, brutally executed in the killing fields of that country. Basically, the philosophy was, the old stuff is bad, only innovative new things are good. And you know, as you track and watch Goals 2000, outcomes-based education, school-to-work, certificates of mastery, and all the terminology which float around in education circles, whether it's coming from the Republicans or the Democrats or the Republicrats, regardless of what you hear, all those words, it's all the same. Some new innovation, some new idea designed to save man through education. If only we can enact this new thing. If only we can bring Pumsy the Dragon into the school systems of Virginia to teach psychobabble to our children so that they can sort of spiritualize their problems with their parents, then we'll have the right sort of relationship. Do you know that people are actually talking today? I mean, this isn't a joke. This was written about in a nationally syndicated newspaper. People are talking about requiring licenses for parents before they're allowed to have children. Oh, it won't be burdensome, they say. All we want to do is to make sure you go through parenting classes. You see, the state knows best. The state knows how to train you and educate you, and if you just go through these classes, all will be well. Ultimately, this isn't going to be burdensome. Just jump into the pot, little froggy. It'll be real nice and cool today. Tomorrow we'll turn it up a little bit. Dabney saw this. He said this, did that old system, by the way, the old system he talked about was a system where parents were in control of education, where societies of individual parents came by on a local basis and helped to get a teacher to come and train their student, or they taught their children at home. They educated them at home. They educated in the morning. They worked around the family homestead. They were trained in the trades and the crafts of their father. They walked alongside their fathers, even as Jesus walked alongside his father when Jesus was 12 years old. That old system, he said, did that old system ever produce perfect results? Did it teach every adult in the state to read and write? He said, no, truthfully it didn't. But neither will the new one. And after all the fuss and iniquitous expense, the upshot will be that there will still be just as many adults in the state who practically will not read and who will forget how as before, and there will be far fewer to use the art of reading to any good purpose. How often will men stubbornly forget that the art of reading, he said, is not education, but only a means of education? The feasible and useful education, he said, is the development of the faculties which takes place in learning of how to earn an honest living, which brings us to the next point that Robert Louis Dabney made. Dabney said, if you force people who do not want to learn and who are not interested in learning to sit through compulsory state education from birth to 18 years of age, you're going to get people who not only are ignorant because they've learned nothing in class, but are good for nothing because they've never been involved in labor. So you have the worst of all possible worlds, but it gets worse than that. Because when they were going through that system where they didn't really learn anything and they didn't want to learn anything and they didn't have time to spend working and learning the value of honest labor, they were also taught atheistic humanism and a radical philosophy of rights that they were owed a living by the government. Long before Lyndon Johnson, long before Franklin Delano Roosevelt, long before the Great Society, long before all of these programs, Robert Louis Dabney said, if you give people handouts, if you put them in government schools, if you don't have explicitly Christian education, what you're going to see are people who believe that the government owes them something. And that, my friends, is the standard, and I submit to you that is the norm amongst people today. The government owes us something. He said this, and I think this is interesting. I just share this with you. My prediction, he said, is already verified in Massachusetts, the very home of the state school humbug. The annual reports of their own school superintendents confess it. A large part of the rural laboring population still do not read, have forgotten how to read, do not care to know, and care not a sliver whether their children know. Here, by the way, is the cause of the new furor over compulsory education. In other words, we need to get all the kids in there. We have to get them in there. Tried by this sober and truthful standard, I assert that the comparative fruits of the old system fully justify its excellence. Again, I demand that the tree will be known by its fruits. And we come to yet another prediction that Robert Louis Dabney made. Robert Louis Dabney predicted that if you have compulsory education and mandatory common school education, the crime rate would go up dramatically. Now, some people at the time said, listen, far better to build schools than jails. You know what Robert Louis Dabney's response? He said, build more schools, you'll have to build more jails. Now, some of us might say, that's counterintuitive. That doesn't make sense. Because after all, if we educate people, won't they be free from that? But let's be careful we don't fall into this wrong thinking that education is the key to economic, spiritual, and societal salvation. Dabney understood that if you bring the people into the classroom, you take away moral training, they're not involved in hard labor, they believe they have rights, they're going to turn into a bunch of criminals. And today, our classrooms are battle zones. And the criminal population has gone up and up and up. The literacy rates have gone down, down, down. And people are afraid for their life. Recent surveys have demonstrated that the number one most dangerous place for a young person to be is in school. He has a greater chance of losing his life, of being maimed, of being beaten up, of being raped in school than any other place in the government school system. This is what Dabney predicted. Perhaps he couldn't even have, even Dabney might not have imagined how far things have gone today. But he saw that the seeds would lead us to the sort of result that we have. Dabney believed that compulsory education was communistic. He used that term. He thought it was because it redistributed wealth. But he said, look, I want to be clear about something. I'm for education. He says, let me at the outset, in response to one of four letters that he wrote against one of his critics, he said, let me at the outset arrest all invidious outcries by saying that I am an advocate of the most universal education possible, provided it be true education. I hardly recognize all the teachings of the golden rule of philanthropy and of equality so far as equality is righteous, which prompt us to desire for all our fellow creatures, so far as possible, all the advantages of culture we value for ourselves, and that without distinguishing against classes. Again, not the words of a bigot, not the words of an unbalanced man, the words of really a highly refined thinker. And he said this, let me say once for all, I am an advocate of aiding and helping poor children. But he went on to say that he believed that it was the role of the family and the church and the community to reach out to help these people. Dabney believed that it was the parents' responsibility. He said this, it's the teaching of the Bible and of sound political ethics that the education of children belong to the sphere of the family and is the duty of the parents, and that theory that children of the commonwealth are the charge of the commonwealth is a pagan one derived from heathen Sparta and Plato's heathen republic and connected by regular logical sequence with legalized prostitution and the dissolution of the conjugal tie. Whew. Dabney doesn't mince words. He says what's on his mind. He said it would lead to more crime. He said it won't help people who don't want to be educated. It's not going to do any good for those people. He said, that which costs nothing will not be valued. And I quote Dabney, there is a natural humiliation, he said, in being compelled to accept the provision of charity or of the state for that which conscience tells parents is obligatory on them. You know something? I don't think that sort of humiliation exists today. Parents don't think twice about accepting the aid. But in an age of honor, of dignity, of integrity, where a man was a man, to simply say, government, you take care, you pay for my kids and take them off my hands, Robert Louis Dabney said, a man who felt comfortable with that should feel humiliation. It's not a normal thing. Our standards have certainly changed, though. These reasons account for the fact, Dabney said, which the advocates of public schools so desire to hide, that children do not attend and the parents do not care to make them attend. He who goes behind the scenes in the northern states know how extensively it's true. The rising movement for compulsory education is a confession of this fact. Dabney said so much. I don't want to keep you here forever. We could read and just enjoy reading so many of Dabney's comments, and there's so much to say. But let's just summarize a few of the prophecies that Dabney made. Dabney predicted that government education would destroy the recipient. I submit to you today that those of us who've gotten on the federal dole, who expect the government handouts, who look forward to it, who are looking for handouts, have become dependent on the state and independent from God, as opposed to our colonial forebears who were dependent on God and independent from the state. I submit Dabney's prophecy was a dead ringer. He said, secondly, it would not educate. Do we have better education today? We have worse education than ever before. When I was in college at William & Mary, the second oldest college in America, supposedly a high-ranking secular institution, and my professor said we were going to read the Federalist Papers, the students objected. It's too hard. We can't understand it. Though it was written for tinkers and cobblers and silversmiths and the average man during the colonial era, Dabney was dead right. Lower literacy rates, lower standards, SAT scores going down in direct proportion to money that's being pumped in. Dabney said this, and I ought to share this one quote. We haven't covered this, but Dabney said brilliantly that if we allow a little bit of this, we will see not the liberals, not the extreme left, but we will see conservatives systematically move more and more towards liberalism and sell us out. And my friends, as we approach an election cycle right now, all of us should tremble as we consider that the difference between the Republican Party leadership and the Democratic leadership on the question of education is so nominal as to be almost undistinguishable. It's a sad truth. For all of our talk against Goals 2000, sure, they limited certain elements of it recently, but it was Bob Dole who recently reauthorized funding for it just 3 months ago. It was George Bush who proposed America 2000, which turned into Goals 2000. We can't simply blame one party. And back in the day of Dabney, Dabney saw the same thing. He said this, Northern conservatism, this is a party which never conserves anything. Its history has been that it demurred to each aggression of the Progressive Party and aims to save its credit by a respectable amount of growling, but it always acquiesces with the last innovation. What was resisted novelty of yesterday is today one of the accepted principles of conservatism. It is now conservative only in affecting to resist the next innovation, which will tomorrow be forced upon its timidity and will be succeeded by some third revolution to be denounced and then adopted in turn. American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward towards perdition. It is worthless because it is only the conservatism of expediency and not of sturdy principle. It intends to risk nothing serious for the sake of the truth. It has no idea of being guilty of the folly of martyrdom. Some people might say that Robert Louis Dabney was engaged in a chaotic adventure with no hope, yet another lost cause. But I remember the words of the general, Mr. Lee. There is a true glory, he said, and a true honor, the glory of duty done, the honor of the integrity of the principle. And it was this principle that Robert Louis Dabney stood on. And for that reason, he could not stomach the compromises and the pusillanimous kowtowing of the Northern conservatives in his day any more than we should tolerate them today. It was Dabney who said and predicted that conservative politicians would compromise. He predicted crime. He predicted that the Bible would be tossed out of the classroom. He predicted that there would raise up a generation of degenerates. He predicted that it would discourage parents from their training responsibilities. He predicted that it would inspire discontent by teaching a false theory of rights. He predicted that dangerous peer grouping trends would evolve, that there would be bad role models. He predicted, interestingly, that if we allow the schools and the government to do this, that it would promote demagoguery and it would create a monopolistic link between government and business, because the textbook manufacturers would get in sync with the government and they would control what was passed out there. Boy, was he on spot. Between the National Education Association, the biggest union monopoly in America, taxpayer subsidized, and all of their minions, and the school textbook manufacturers, they are hand in glove, linked in the propagation of their own radical views in the classroom. Dabney was right on spot. He predicted self-interest. He predicted that it would set off a generation of people who saw nothing wrong with legal plunder, which is precisely what we have today. My friends, Robert Louis Dabney was a prophet. He was a great man of God, and he spoke his mind. His words are hard for us. They're tough to swallow at times. We find ourselves challenged by them, discouraged sometimes, because we see the truth of it, and it goes to the very heart of us. But if they're true, and I submit to you they are, if they are true, then we have a standard that needs to be raised. The issues have all been discussed before. They've been dealt with. There's nothing new under the sun. Nothing has changed. And Robert Louis Dabney dealt with it over 100 years ago. I'd like to, on this occasion, close by dedicating a poem, which I wrote for this weekend, for Pastor Lloyd Sprinkle, in grateful appreciation for the work that he has done in producing my hero, Robert Louis Dabney, perhaps the name of my next child, I don't know. And this is just an ode to Mr. Dabney I dedicate to you, Brother Sprinkle. We must remember Thornwell, Palmer, Girardot, all Southern men who preach with power, unity, and flow. But when it comes to logic pure, there's one who tops our list. Hail Dabney, prophet of the South, great apologist. Geneva had its Calvin, Rome its Augustine, England had its Cromwell to fight the libertine, but in our land there was but one who dared to turn the tide of reconstructionistic zeal and Yankeedom's foul pride. The feminist, the plutocrat, the wily carpetbagger, the Darwinist, the bureaucrat, the transcendental braggart, the scalawag, the suffragette, the surly statist simp, were by your pen defrocked, exposed, and wounded, left to limp. The solemnistic wisdom from your pugilistic pen has rendered impotent the creeds of far less noble men, and with the keen perceptive flair that exceeds Nostradamus, your prophecies have proven wrong each foolish doubting Thomas. You make us leave our comfort zone and re-engage the battle, content no more to tolerate the sophomoric prattle of socialist republicrats and those who compromise. No longer may we coddle them or listen to their lies. And so, with joy, we doff our hats and shout from every mouth, Hail Dabney, wise apologist, defender of the South. Thank you so much.